Welcome to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The Vancouver Writers' Fest connects people to exceptional books, ideas, and dialogue through year-round programming that ignites a passion for words and the world around us. I'm Leslie Hertig, Artistic Director, and I'm very happy to share this conversation featuring Taping Chen and Peak Shuang Feng in conversation with Anna Ling Kay. This event was recorded on October 23rd, 2021, as part of our Fall Festival. The Vancouver Writers' Fest carries out its work, including this event you're about to listen to, on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This event, titled The Threads of Family and Resilience, features Taping Chen talking about her acclaimed story collection, Land of Big Numbers, and Peak Shuang Feng with her novel, Ghost Forest. They're in conversation with 2021 RBC Bronwyn Wallace Award for Emerging Writers Prize winner, Anna Ling Kay.
Thanks so much, Leslie, and thank you so much to the Vancouver Writers' Fest for having me on again. I am so excited about today's event, but I would like to begin by also gratefully acknowledging that this festival takes place on the unceded homelands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nation. I'm so pleased to be speaking with Taping Chen and Peak Shuang Feng on their highly accoladed fiction debuts. And I also want to say thank you to all of you out there in the internet for welcoming the Vancouver Writers' Fest into your home and your home offices. So I'd like to start by introducing Peak Shuang Feng. Peak Shuang Feng is a Canadian writer and artist living in New York City. She has made waves with her first novel, Ghost Forest. Her work is described by the Vancouver Sun as a delicate, beautifully wrought story that elevates the fragmentary form and captures the universal experience of loss. Fiction is the recipient of fellowships and residencies from the Asian American Writers Workshop, Kundiman, the Malay Colony, and Story Knife. Today, she is here to help us discuss her novel of history inherited in the 21st century China and the particulars of Chinese and Canadian Chinese family dynamics. Fiction, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so sorry that we can't have you back in person to Vancouver this year. But I was wondering, if we had had the good fortune to welcome you home and you were here in Vancouver, would there be anything on your must-do or must-eat list?
Yeah, I love, I'm obsessed with Chef Tony's seafood restaurant in Richmond. And every time I come back to Vancouver, I have to go there and have dim sum. So yeah, that would probably be my first place to visit.
Oh, well, I hope we can make that happen soon and it's not too distant to reality.
But me too.
Virtually, welcome to the Vancouver Writers' Fest.
Thank you.
And now I'd like to introduce Taping Chen. Taping Chen's writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, Guernica, Tin House, and The Atlantic. She is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal and was previously a correspondent for a paper in Beijing and Hong Kong. Prior to that, Taping spent a year in China as a Fulbright Fellow. Her debut book, The Land of Big Numbers, has many accolades, including a coveted spot on Barack Obama's summer reading list of 2021. Taping, welcome to the Vancouver Writers' Fest.
Thanks, it's great to be here.
I'm super curious, if you could indulge me for a second, when your book is included on Obama's reading list, do you get a letter or a certificate? Or do you just like screen cap that as quickly as possible and just share it to anyone? Just be like, oh, look.
I was actually in the process of waking my son up from a nap and my husband walked it through the door and he was like, have you seen your phone? Because I'm always losing my phone. And so I thought, and I was like, I know where my phone is. I know where it is. And he was like, no, have you seen it? And then he told me Barack Obama would be here. We had no warning whatsoever. I mean, my face, he said, I just like turned white, like I'd seen a ghost. I'm like, what? And then I just would not believe it until I, of course, like run to the internet and confirmed apparently it was actually true. Yeah, it was crazy. It was really exciting.
And that's it. They just leave it there and they don't get in touch. And, you know, well, it's pretty amazing. So congratulations for that. Much deserved. So I thought I'd start with a concept from Fiction's novel, which describes the Chinese artistic discipline called xieyi, or to write meaning. Xieyi, as described in Ghost Forest, isn't interested in depicting the physical likeness of things so much as the idea of them, and leaves large areas of the parchment blank. In that segment, the narrator notes that the empty space was as important as form, that absence was as important as presence. And what fills that absence is the artist's spirit. Of course, I couldn't help seeing resonances in your writing, Fiction, which is a series of sparse but vibrantly evocative linked vignettes. Can you speak on how your background and training as a visual artist influenced your choices as a writer?
Yeah. I trained as a painter for many years, and it was actually when I was doing my grad school, my master's at the School of Visual Arts, that I started writing. I was trying to find my voice as a painter, and I started questioning whether I still wanted to keep painting or if I wanted to try sculpture and installation. And I started making these videos. And then between my first and second years of grad school, my dad passed away, and I was in this space of grief. And I ended up writing, and I wrote out a couple of vignettes from this kind of dreamlike state of grief that I was in. And I ended up recording myself reading it out loud onto my iPhone, and using that as voiceover for these video pieces I made. But over time, I realized I didn't want to think about the visual elements anymore. So I just wrote more and more of these vignettes, and I printed them out on tiny pieces of paper and rearranged them on the floor like over and over. And after 7 years, it just became this novel. So the silences and the pauses and the rhythm of the words, like all of that was really influenced by beginning it as like a sound video project.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. And it sounds like there were, because you said over a period of 7 years, there were actual silences in between the writing of the pieces, like just physically, you just let time and space kind of take their course as well.
Yeah, because I didn't plan to write a book in the beginning because I was in art school, and I didn't really think that I would be able to, like at certain points, just getting all the rejections, trying to make the transition from being a visual artist to a writer. Like I just had all these doubts along the way. And so there were many periods when I wasn't writing at all. So there were definitely lots of silences in between.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you for sharing some of that journey. Deping, I think I've seen it that you've proclaimed yourself a magpie of a writer, collecting details from your work as a Wall Street journalist in Beijing and finding a home for them in this debut collection. And that really resonated for me because I had a very brief interlude in journalism, and I was so frustrated because I couldn't use so many of the visceral details when reporting. So it definitely resonated for me. But could you share a bit about how it's been for you moving between journalistic writing and fiction?
Yeah, and I think that trait that you identify being sort of a bit of a magpie, I feel like in part that's what drew me to journalism too, just, you know, this feeling of seeing things around you and wanting to take them in and somehow distill them into something else, just collect and try and make sense of the world through them. And so, I mean, that's something obviously a big part of the discipline of journalism. But just as you say, I mean, I found just in my life living in Beijing and in Hong Kong, just constantly feeling like there, you know, you get to distill maybe like 1/100th, right, of any scene or story or place into, say, a news article. And it, China really is just the sort of incredibly big, propulsive story that doesn't feel like it really could fit into any one news story or book, or really, you know, it's just such, it felt to me like I was constantly getting, in some ways, pulled into just seeing seeds of stories all over. And when I started finally to write these short stories, it was with a feeling of just like extraordinary relief to finally have a place where I could start putting, you know, all these sorts of details and bits and moments and just things that had stuck with me for so long. And really, you know, it was a process, of course, that happened when I was there with the Wall Street Journal, and also really starting back in 2006 when I first moved to the country. And it was, it's a feeling, for me, it was really a feeling of, there's a character in the book, Tal Tal. He's this rural inventor who sets out to build an airplane, and he has this warehouse that's sort of crammed full of relics and cast-offs from the village. And that's sort of what I felt like of it. You know, he sits down and tries to create meaning out of them, and, or in his case, literal inventions, everything from a noodle chopping robot to an airplane. And likewise for me, it was kind of this feeling of sitting down and looking and saying, okay, well, as I started to write, sort of, you know, going back in and then figuring out where I could piece them together, sort of like a quilt. I'm mixing a million metaphors here.
No, I love Tao Tao, and I am a big connoisseur of noodle chopping robots, and now I will forever associate their invention with him. So I'm like forever in this in-between land of fact and fiction, I think, because I don't know who invented noodle chopping robots, but I would like to believe it's Tao Tao. So thank you for that origin story. I wanted to ask both of you a question, because as I was looking into some kind of your origin stories, I know that both of you have done some research and recording of your family stories. And I think, you know, growing up in immigrant families, I have Taiwanese background myself. We can't help but be the inheritors of stories and also look at things through the prism of more than one culture or community. So I was wondering, how did these projects of looking into your family stories influence these books? Maybe Pixuan, could you start us off?
Sure. I think that, I started asking my grandmother about her life stories at some point in college. I don't remember exactly what inspired me to do it, but ever since then, every time I see her, I ask her to tell me a bit more. And that definitely became a really big inspiration for the part of Ghost Forest that has these oral histories with the grandmother and the mother characters of the narrator. And I think that what was important for me to capture in these oral histories was not just, you know, the traumatic and sad things that happened, but also, you know, a sense of humor and playfulness and the joy and intelligence and creativity of the mother and the grandmother, and just to kind of capture the complexity of their characters instead of just trying to, you know, portray one side of them.
Thank you. And Deping, do you?
Yeah.
I know it doesn't map as much on your project, but you also had that lived experience of moving between cultures and so on.
Yeah. And the research that you mentioned, it is something that was something that was sort of happening at points sort of as I was finishing the book. So as I was finishing Land of Big Numbers, I was at the same time researching and figuring out, I had found this old trunk that had these letters written by my great grandmother to my grandmother. And they were from this Beijing address. And I had growing up, I'd been raised in a household where we just didn't talk about my mom's side of the family. It was really a black box. She had been raised in a household where it just, you know, like her mother didn't want to talk. There was some painful history there. And anyway, I was raised really not knowing it, any of it. And I was, as I was writing Land of Big Numbers, I was also going into some of this history, namely, you know, sort of going to this address and figuring out who lived there and who these people were. And it turned out that actually my great grandfather had been both a journalist as well as a poet. In Beijing about 100 years precisely before I had moved there to also work for a newspaper. He previously lived in New York, Hawaii, and Japan and all over, but had wound up in Beijing to sort of chronicle this particular moment in time. And for me, I mean, you know, I don't know how it necessarily influenced the writing of Land of Big Numbers, but I can say personally, definitely it felt really meaningful to trace some of the history. One, because it felt like reclaiming instead of recapturing this lost chapter in some ways, certainly of our family's history, and also more broadly in Chinese history, because my great-grandfather, he was very much part of an intellectual movement and an era, you know, when he and his party thought that a democratic future was possible. And it was just, so I spent a lot of time reading sort of newspapers of that era and thinking about sort of journalism then and now. And I would say too, I think the other thing, I mean, it was obviously fascinating, but I think personally too, just having been someone who spent a lot of time obviously working as a journalist and also sort of wrestling with the place of fiction in my life, and feeling like for a long time, that was something that it was just something that existed privately for me. I just never talked about it to anybody really. And so stumbling on someone in my own family who had been a journalist, but also, you know, was a poet too, that just felt like such a wonderful, just a bit of serendipity to see. And it felt like in some ways, I felt encouraged in what I was doing too.
Yeah, kind of like an ancestral guide of sorts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you for sharing some of those backgrounds. I think this would be a lovely place to take in some reading so we can connect with the texts. If you don't mind, Fiction, would you be able to read first?
Of course. So, okay, I'm just going to read from the first few pages of the novel. Bird. 21 days after my dad died, a bird perched on the railing of my balcony. It was brown. It stayed there for a long time. "Hi, Dad," I said. "Thanks for checking up on me." I lay down on the couch and read some emails on my phone. When I looked up again, the bird was gone. Guai. In my family, the best thing a child could be was guai. It meant you were good. It meant you did as you were told. When I was 4 or maybe 6, I found out I was supposed to have a baby brother. But my mom said the baby flew to the sky, and that was why my dad was sad those days. "But why is he sad?" I asked. "Because he's a traditional Chinese father and he wants to have a son." "Try to cheer him up." "Okay," I said. I decided I would be so guai, I would be more perfect than a son. Astronaut family. I was 3 and a half when we immigrated to Canada. Like many other families, we left Hong Kong before the 1997 handover. They say almost a sixth of the city left during this time. My dad had seen news stories of Hong Kongers who couldn't find jobs in their new countries. Stories of managers who became dishwashers because they couldn't speak the new language. Like many other fathers, my dad decided he didn't want to leave his job in manufacturing behind. To help my mom, my grandma and grandpa agreed to move with us to Canada. That spring, my dad took 2 weeks off from work, and the 5 of us headed to Kai Tak Airport. All my aunts and uncles came to the departure gates to see us off. In Canada, there were more Hong Kong immigrants than in any other country. And in Vancouver, I had many classmates whose fathers stayed in Hong Kong for work too. I didn't think of my family as different. I thought, this is what Hong Kong fathers do. Astronaut family. It's a term invented by the Hong Kong mass media. A family with an astronaut father. Flying here, flying there. So fresh. As we walked out of the arrivals at the Vancouver airport, our family friends waved their arms. "Isn't the air so fresh in Canada?" they said. For 2 weeks, we stayed at their house in the Richmond neighborhood, and they drove us everywhere. We ate dim sum in Aberdeen Center, a new mall known as Little Hong Kong, and posed for pictures in Stanley Park, feeding breadcrumbs to the geese. But mostly we were jet lagged, riding in the back of their beige minivan, asleep with open mouths. 2 weeks later, after we moved into our new house, they drove us back to the Vancouver airport, where my mom looked at me and said, "Say bye-bye to your dad now. He's flying back to Hong Kong." U Street. Through the windows of our new house, I saw plump, pointy trees and blurry, switching trees. Everywhere outside was green. At night, my mom slept in her bedroom, my grandpa in his. I shared a room with my grandma since we were always together. Three generations under one roof. Thick, lick, that, lat. Thick, lick, that, lat. Thick, lick, that, lat. In her new house in Vancouver, everywhere outside was rain.
Thanks so much for that reading. And it's very cool because right now in Vancouver, it's going tick, lick, dot, lock, tick, lick, dot, lock. Going until tomorrow, I'm told, maybe all week. So thank you. Daping, would you care to share a passage as well?
Sure. That was beautiful. I thought I would read from this short story, New Fruit, which is set in a Beijing neighborhood, one of the old hutongs in the city. And starts like this. It was a peculiar fruit, the orange-red, tawny skin, its flesh dense and velvety and luxurious. It was shaped roughly like an egg with a tiny yellow pit, sold packed into crates lined with its deeply green leaves. The fruit had a taste marvelous and rare, sweet with an underside of acid. We lined up for blocks to buy it from street peddlers. We exchanged bites, though never satisfactorily. What tasted to me like the look of freshly arranged sunflowers in a green vase might taste to you like the way your daughter's tiny socked feet sounded romping down the hall. For Lao Zhou, it smelled like it did when he wiped the shavings off a bench he'd carved himself and applied a creamy varnish. For Zhu Ai, it was the scent of her mother cooking rice, long remembered from childhood, and the sound of rain outside. For others, it was the look of mingled envy and admiration that came when you were young and beautiful and wearing something new that suited you exactly. The fruit had arrived one day in trucks at the city's wholesale market in crates that said Sunshine Produce, sharing space with peaches and plums and grapes and other fruit with which we were more familiar. At first, it was just the peddlers who sold the fruit, who picked it up because it was cheap and novel and sweet, but soon grocery stores were stocking it too, under the name Xiguo, peculiar fruit. Lao Zhou was the first on the street to try it. He was a widower who woke early every morning and did his shopping, was usually among the first at the neighborhood market. One day in April, he came back with a dozen of the fruit swaying in a plastic bag and handed them to anyone he saw. "Try it," he said, an alertness in his voice that surprised us. Peng Ai, out for a stroll, took one curiously. The first bite made her cheeks burn softly pink. "Oh," she said, "oh, how tasty." Those of us who stood watching the exchange between her and Lao Zhou raised our eyebrows. There was something private in that moment, even though Peng Ai was frequently found gossiping while squatting in the common privies, and it would not have occurred to us, to any of us, to suspect her of holding anything in reserve. Those of us who ate the Xiguo noticed that the sun was warm on our limbs, and the sound of a bicycle bell tinkling outside reminded us of the warm air of the spring breeze of possibilities. We smiled more often, let our eyes meet in the street. Today I had one that tasted like I had just told a good joke, and everyone was laughing, Lao Sui might say. Mothers would feed mashed up pieces of the fruit to their babies, and we'd crowd around to watch the surprise and wonder that transformed their small faces. We were kinder to one another that season. Mr. Feng, who worked at a local bank, tasted a Xiguo one morning, and afterward it occurred to him that the metal door at the entrance to the apartment building was sticking, so that the elderly woman who lived on the first floor could sometimes be seen standing outside, waiting for a neighbor to enter or exit so she could slip in behind them. He grabbed some pliers and went downstairs to see whether he could fix it. Other changes happened, big and small. To everyone's astonishment, Zhu Ai's son, who lived with her on the third floor, quit his job at a local factory and moved south to be a painter. He had taken a bite of the Xiguo and, so he said, seen a sunset of moist silver and cloudy gold that he was determined to capture on canvas. No matter, so his mother said, that he had no talent and would come to a bad end. Lao Zhou, who worked as the neighborhood handyman, was often seen eating the fruit. That spring, he found himself singing more often as he swung his hammer, feeling a long dormant restlessness in his blood. He noticed the young girls in the neighborhood were wearing high-waisted skirts that seemed to be the new fashion. He noticed the far-off sound of a revving engine in the distance. The day he'd given Pang Ai her first piece of the fruit, he noticed that the shape of her waist was still visible, even in the baggy shirt she wore now. And though they had known each other for years, there was a freshness about her eyes that surprised him. For the first time, it occurred to him, tasting the chihua, that he was not yet an old man. The only one on the block who refused to try the fruit was Mr. Sun, Pang Ai's husband. A retired railway inspector, he had a stubborn streak and refused to eat most fruits, preferring instead to subsist on his wife's hand-pulled noodles and crescent moon-shaped dumplings. He was a sober man, not giving to talking much, though he did inveigh against the chihua when his wife asked. Not natural, he said. Don't trust it.
Thank you so much, Toping. Just the density of detail and the way everyone in that neighborhood just comes to life with those deftly chosen thoughts. It's so beautiful and it's so exciting and it feels so true. So thank you so much for sharing that excerpt. In both of your passages you've chosen, there's actually an aspect that delighted me about both of your books in that you both incorporate actual Chinese words, guai and qi guo. As well as many other sayings that are incorporated into the English writing in all their kind of delight. For example, fiction, you have Cantonese sayings, you mentioned the tiklik taklak and the onomatopoeic bingling banglang to describe things falling and crashing, and doping, there are sections like the scene in On the Street Where You Live where the character teaches beautiful but practical phrases like mao toying, which means cat-headed eagle, which is the Chinese word for owl. All of these are like little details that I also have collected in my lifetime. And it's just so exciting as a writer to see them incorporated into fiction. And I was wondering, how did you navigate incorporating Chinese language into your writing? And what kinds of choices or rules did you have to make for yourself? May Deping, could you share?
Yeah, something? I think for me, that's part of what I really relished about getting to write fiction, was just the fact that you could drop things in the text and not have to explain them too much. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like, for example, you take a detail like a noodle chopping robot or something, and if it was a news article, I would have to explain sort of the context and sort of the economics and why this is happening and taking off. And whereas you can just let it exist sort of in the context of the story and let the characters build their lives around such a detail. And just, I felt similarly about language. It was something that, so often I'd have had the experience of trying to contort myself to translate something into a newspaper article. And I really enjoyed getting to here and there. I mean, where it felt in some ways like if something just didn't sound like it would translate well, then I just left it in the text as it was. And that felt like kind of a gift to be able to do. And also just, you know, in terms of how to navigate it, I think it was really at, it really varied for certain stories. I mean, I think like, for example, the what I was just reading, New Fruit. I mean, that whole story has sort of like a magical realist, fabulistic kind of quality. And, I was conscious of using, so for example, like saying Lao Zhou, like instead of, you see often in the text, like old so-and-so. And sometimes like that felt, does feel appropriate for students, but in the context of New Fruit, it just felt like not wanting to kind of in some ways interrupt like the reader in that way and just letting the,
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I find that translations can be more disruptive than not, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So you did have a guideline if it flowed and if it made sense in the text.
Yeah, and not wanting to make it, just not wanting it to feel obtrusive in either direction, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That totally makes sense. Big Shun, how about yourself?
Yeah, I think I... similarly, also didn't want it to feel obtrusive. I mean, while I was drafting, I went down these like funny paths where at one point I would, because, okay, so I speak Cantonese with my family, but I only learned how to read and write in college and I learned Mandarin. So my reading level isn't very high. And I also like I only know how to type Chinese characters in pinyin. So I would go through this complicated process of like trying to, thinking of the Cantonese character and then trying to figure out what the pinyin was and then typing out my computer and then putting the character into my manuscript. And then I had this realization, and often like I would get like the wrong character. But I had this realization that I was like, you know, like I really wanted to write this for people like me, like Asian diasporic readers. And so I decided to keep it only, I would use only like romanization of certain Cantonese characters and only for proverbs and, you know, or certain sounds that I wanted to capture. So it was only where I felt like I really couldn't say it in English.
Yeah, thank you. No, and I definitely noticed that, you know, with the one exception of that word guai, which was in there. To me, it just felt really radical to see like a Chinese character right there, or like in the second chapter. So yeah, thank you for sharing some of that process. I wanted to talk a bit about feelings. So much fiction, so much of Ghost Forest is essentially about feelings, the desire to articulate them, the cultural bias towards leaving feelings unspoken, and what happens when generations attempt to bridge that gap in their emotional vocabulary. And I was curious about the evolution of relationship to feeling in the novel. Did these breakthroughs occur through the writing? Because there's definitely all the characters have an evolution through the novel. Or was the writing a result of insights into a family's relationship to feeling? Does that make sense as a question?
I'm not sure. I think maybe like I was writing from an emotional place inside myself. And one of the reasons why I chose not to include a lot of sensory details, and I wasn't interested in, you know, like setting a scene or creating a vivid grounding experience, especially in the beginning, was because I wanted to kind of mimic this experience of grief. And I structured these vignettes in a non-linear way, but like linked by feeling. So, you know, sometimes if I have a vignette that I feel is more sad, then I would put one after that that I felt is more light and playful. But it wasn't, I think that most of it was like things were just happening in parallel. It wasn't like only one approach. And yeah, I hope that sort of answers your question.
Yeah, I think it really does. That actually, that's part of the vibrancy of the text. It feels really kinetic. So there's a sense of it occurring as you read, which I think is really effective. Thank you for sharing some of that process. Tuffing, in the story—
Sorry, my nose is ticking like crazy. Can I just like mute and go off camera for a second and like blow my nose exponentially?
Please, go ahead.
We're back. So sorry.
Go ahead. I think we'll take a break in the questioning because my question was for Tuping, but picture, I just individual, like not a formal question, but I'm curious, do you think of this as memoir or as a fictional novel? Because in all the publicity, I've seen it as a novel and I didn't know how to approach it.
Yeah, definitely a novel. I mean, even though I wrote it in the beginning, I was inspired by my own experience. I just like wasn't interested in writing something to say, this is what happened to me. Like I didn't want to have to stick to the facts of my life. And it was just more important for me to write something that had a lot of space, like little interiority and a lot of space for the reader to like bring their own emotions and experiences. So it's definitely not a memoir.
Okay. So there are aspects that are made up, or made up, I guess. Interesting. Amazing. Wow. Well, you know, you're really successful and people are like, I'm convinced that's her, right? So yeah, thank you. Okay, Dauphine, you didn't miss anything. We were just kind of doing green room talk, basically. And if it's okay, can I direct the next?
Please, yeah.
Okay, great. Dauphine, in the story Lulu, readers are introduced to the story of twin siblings who grew up in modern China, one boy and one girl. And there's the striking image of the twin blue laptops they're given as they head to very different colleges and futures. The decisions the twins make on how to use those laptops affects the course of their lives in dramatic ways. Could you describe the journey of Lulu and her brother and the feelings that trail through their relationship?
Yeah. So Lulu and her brother, the brother who narrates the story, they're born, of course, in the same household. They're twins. Their lives take incredibly divergent paths. You sort of start to see it happening, as they get gifted these twin laptops and go off to college. One of them, Lulu, becomes essentially sort of an online dissident, an activist in her own small way, one that eventually attracts the attention of the state. And her brother, by contrast, becomes a professional video gamer. Mm-hmm. And as far as the feelings that accompany that journey, I mean, a lot of it, of that story is seeing, it's the story of an exceptional woman, essentially, Lulu, who's born in these circumstances and is someone who just has this incredible sense of conscience and desire to affect the world around her and sort of an inability to kind of accept the world around her as it's handed to her. And we see her embark on this increasingly dangerous path. Mm-hmm. And we see sort of this, we see it all through the filter of her brother's eyes. And it's really it's a feeling of at times, I think bafflement, of course, concern, fear, all of that mixed with a sense, I think at times too, of a little bit of, I think in the background of it all, there is a sense of respect too for what is this. I mean, it's of course it's he's seeing his loved one just embark on this collision course with the state, but also it's just this incredibly complex feeling of she's putting the family in jeopardy. He's so frustrated with her, but at the same time, there's more to what she's doing, and he on some level, some deep level, can see that too. And so it's a lot of complex feelings, I think, underlying that relationship. And just that was something that fascinated me in exploring the character of Lulu, because she's the sort of person who you do meet in China with some frequency, who just someone who has a sense of the world as it should be and is unafraid to speak their minds. And sometimes me say as a reporter, you want to grab them and you're thinking, what are you doing? And just at a human level, seeing the toll that it can take. It's just, there's a kind of really stubborn, incredible idealism that you encounter at times. And when we see it erupt in this family, of course, it splits people apart. And yet at the same time, I think the brother too wants his sister's respect. And in some ways, we see not exactly the shadow that her life has cast upon his own life choices, but you do see him, I think, just, in some ways he has all the success, right? But there's a degree to which it doesn't feel as tethered to reality, I think, as it could, given, of course, what we see happening to his sister and what he knows more of the society around him that she's opened up for him.
Yeah, it's an incredibly complicated and ambitious story. And I think that through line of the concern and love that the siblings have for each other, even as they take like such different decisions, it's so effective. And the really moving part for me is actually kind of like the shadow feeling that Lulu has for her brother, because she keeps checking in with him and you can see that she has so much that she wants to share, but she can't, for his own protection, kind of. And she's just trying to protect her family, even as she, as you said, harms them as well. Just
yeah, and just the way that you can sort of end up becoming a stranger in some ways to a loved one, even as you know them so intimately and care for them so deeply. I think, you know, there's a moment when the brother looks at his sister and sees her in some ways as so alien. And that, I think, to me, is such a central question of fiction, is like, to what extent can we ever really know each other? And to what extent can we understand each other? And yeah, and to see it in that sort of like really charged family setting was something that, yeah, and writing it for me, I found just really pulled me along.
Incredible. Thank you for sharing some of that. It kind of brings me back to that concept in the Xie Yi painting discipline of absence being as important as presence. And in, you know, there's Lulu comes in and out of prison. And of course, in Ghost Forest, there's the obvious parallel of the father's absence in the girl's upbringing, and later his presence in the narrator's adult life, and eventually a new absence as his illness takes hold. Absence and presence is such a consistent cycle in the case of Ghost Forest in Chinese immigrant reality fiction. I was wondering if you could speak on what you discovered in the writing of a relationship like that of the narrator and her father.
Yeah, I think one of my biggest realizations was that I started out thinking I was writing a book about grief, mm-hmm. but over time I realized that it was a book about love, and that it's not just about grief and death, but also about this love and devotion within the family, and also the joy among the daughter, sister, mother, and grandmother. So yeah, I think, like, you know, there's absence and there's presence, there's grief, but then there's love and joy. And like, so much for me, closer to the second half of writing it, was just finding a balance in these different elements and trying to represent like the different nuances of this experience.
Mm, beautiful. Yeah, it makes me think of the Mandarin phrase, like, I miss you, it's 我想你. So I miss you. It seems like it's an absence, but I'm thinking of you. So you're present in my missing you. That's really beautiful. Topping in the story Shanghai Murmur, there's also kind of a dealing with absence and presence, but it's in a very different way. It's about a migrant worker who sells flowers in a wealthy neighborhood. And she makes a series of decisions that change her life and her perspective. Can you discuss the themes of class, visibility, and individuality that were woven through Shelley's story?
Yeah, so one thing that always struck me living and traveling in China is just, you know, some of the, when I would come back and forth to the States, of course, people are like, oh, there must be so much culture shock. And I would always think, no, the biggest culture shock is in China. Like when you go between, you know, a small town like where Shelley was based, and then you go to a city like Shanghai. Mm-hmm. And so, and to have all that exist within, you know, one country, and it's just such an incredible gaping contradiction. And I think to be a citizen of a place like Shelley does, and to grow up feeling like you inhabit one kind of reality, and then to arrive in a city like Shanghai, where, you know, I think for her, it is a class story in a lot of ways, obviously. But I also think for Shelley, it's a story a lot about idealism too, right? And the ways that we project ourselves onto places sometimes, or people. So Shelley arrives, and you know, in many ways she falls in love with the city, right? She falls in love with what it could mean for her, how it might transform her. She sees, you know, she has kind of this gauzy sense of possibilities, right, inherent in a place like Shanghai. And likewise, this customer that she falls in love with, she, in the same way, you know, she constructs this elaborate sort of fantasy life for him that exists, you know, she fleshes him out in her head like he's a character, and he is. And of course, at some point their realities collide. But up until then, yeah, I mean, I think it's a story really of course very much about class, but also a lot of what it signifies, like this feeling of longing, and what it stands for in a lot of ways. And for her, you know, what we see in that story is, of course, an awakening in some ways to really the through realities. You know, maybe she starts at a place of idealism, but wakes up more to the realities of class, I guess is one way to think about kind of the through line for that story.
And what's so powerful about that story is society wishes her to be invisible. Like she's almost like a ghost, and you know, it's like she preferably just stay behind that counter. Yeah. But her ability to imagine, she inserts herself into the narrative in a way,
yeah.
in a way that's electrifying to a reader, but to a society that wants her to be invisible, it's almost like it's empowering, but it's also threatening to kind of like that norm. So it is a very quietly exciting story.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I mean, at heart, she's essentially a storyteller, Shelley, as we all are to some extent.
Yeah. Speaking of storytellers, there's this very beautiful filigree of the narrator's in Ghost Forest, of the narrator's mother's voice and the grandmother's voice interspersing the larger narrative. And sometimes one voice illuminates a new aspect in the others. For example, the mother talks of the terrible conditions of the social housing apartment where she grew up in Hong Kong, but then the grandmother tells that story. And the attainment of that relatively large apartment compared to everyone else's is actually a triumph of innovation and risk-taking. Pikshvin, what drew you to include the voices of the mother and the grandmother? And did you find yourself drawn more to specific types of stories, like triumphant, sadness, you know, and so on, over others when exploring these intergenerational perspectives?
Yeah, there are a few different reasons I chose to tell their stories in their own voices. And one of them is that I feel like in Asian families, it's so much more about the family than the individual. And I wanted to approach it in this kind of like collective form of storytelling where the mother and the grandmother could speak for themselves instead of having the narrator just, you know, tell their stories for them. And then on a craft level, that was another way that I created more space inside the book, because by having the mother and grandmother tell their stories, having all these multiple perspectives was a way that I hoped that the reader could draw their own connections instead of having everything explained and having the mother and grandmother choose what they say and choose what not to share, I feel like was really important to capture in this dynamic. And as for what kinds of stories, I think that I was really just drawn to having a range and not just focusing on sad stories or traumatic stories, but to include funny stories and you know, stories that show how brilliant and creative that the mother and grandmother were, especially because I feel like women of those generations often don't get to speak for themselves, or they're, you know, not included in historical accounts. So yeah, it was just important for me to capture those, like a range of sides of those characters.
Really interesting. It is interesting reading these two books together because they touch on so many similar themes, but in such different ways. So, Zofing, you read from the story Qigua, New Fruit, which introduces the fruit that has the ability to enhance nostalgia in a beautiful way. And then the next season, it enhances it in a different way. In a way, was Chico a story about memory and intergenerational perspectives as well? And is it a story about, you know, is there an editing of stories in that one?
Yes. that's exactly what the story is about. It's very much about memory and the editing of memory and how memory is or isn't preserved between generations, right? And you know, I didn't want it to feel like a really heavily political sort of form of allegory or anything, but of course that's very much woven into the story. Just, you know, contextually, we see a group of characters who of course have lived through some extraordinary traumas, right? Individually and collectively in the country. And we start to see as the fruit, as the fruit enters a new season, we see those stories start to emerge in ways that had been for so long repressed. And that story is about so many things, but that's just one part of what always was so striking living in a neighborhood like that in Beijing was just, you know, those neighborhoods tend to skew older. And so, you know, you're walking around side by side, passing people who every day carry a lot of these stories with them, some in the not too distant past that don't get expressed. And, you know, when you start to think about that and just to have that awareness of people around you and just a feeling in some ways of, on the surface, of course, so much of the conversation in those sorts of environments, it's a lot of, you know, there's like the very gossipy sort of character of the neighborhood and like everybody bound up in sort of the minute dramas of each other's lives, which also you see in the story, but also there's, of course, at the same time, these much bigger dramas that exist in everybody's lives that nobody's talking about that finally, you know, through the vehicle of this fruit get brought to the fore.
Mm-hmm. And then eventually the fruit, you know, it's replaced by other fruits. Basically.
The government finds its own ways, yeah, to turn it to its own ends as it usually does.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciated that that leap into magical realism and just how effective it was in reflecting a reality that does occur. And it was just such a beautiful lyrical encapsulation of a very interesting social phenomenon. So thank you for that. I wanted to talk about humor. In Ghost Forest, a large section is set in a hospital as a family member battles illness. And many of these scenes are actually amongst the funniest in the book, whilst others in that same section are the most poignant and vulnerable. Pixuan, can you share what humor's role was in this project?
Yeah, I just felt that humor was such an important part of my book because I didn't want to write a book that felt really dense and heavy and melancholy. Even though it's a book about grief, I still wanted it to be light and playful and have this balance of humor in it. So yeah, it was just really important for me just like to capture grief, not as like one note, because in my own experience of grief, there's just so many different emotions that occur with it, like absurd moments, very practical moments, like you still feel hungry. And I just wanted to capture that all of that in a realistic way. So humor was definitely a big part of that.
Yeah. And kind of, I'm married into a Cantonese family myself, and I think there's just a lot of humor built into the language as well, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, I'm so happy you brought that up, actually. Like, I feel like the humor in my family is just something that I appreciate and cherish so much, and I wanted to capture that in the book as well.
No, you 100% do, another thing I really like is a lot of the humor is actually just the daughters find the father so amusing, and I just love that there's just, then, you know, that has to have its place in an intergenerational narrative, just, you know, just like, oh, dad. You know? Yeah. It's not humor that pervades the story of Land of Big Numbers, but the main character, Zhu Feng, is very optimistic as he makes some unusual decisions. And you can't help but feel fond of him as he does this. Can you speak on your inspiration for that story?
Yeah, so Land of Big Numbers, that story came about. I was in a restaurant eavesdropping on a conversation between two men. They were talking about the case of a government bureaucrat who had been stealing from the government and investing in the stock market. And it was, to their mind, a really clever scheme. It was because he was taking the money, but the stock market kept going up. And so he could keep replacing the money. So he wasn't technically stealing. He was just sort of making use of a resource. Mm-hmm. And I always kind of loved the story because of just like the really practical nature of it. And also the very practical sort of way it was being discussed. Like, oh yeah, you know, no one's, you know, it's a good idea. And then of course you just can't help but wonder what happens to a government bureaucrat like that as the stock market has its ups and downs, as obviously does even in a place like China. And so that was really the genesis of the piece. I just kept thinking about who would be this person who would take on such an audacious scheme. And that story for me was, trying to channel kind of what it's like to be a young bureaucrat in sort of like a third tier city, when you see so much wealth being created around you and want desperately to partake, and this feeling of, in some ways, of wealth being this just something that you don't understand, but everyone else is partaking. And you, in his case, you know, we see a lot of this being animated by a sort of envy for his childhood friend. And this, the way that the stock market for him and this incredibly kind of game of chicken that he's playing in some ways, becomes, it is a game. And you know, that's something that, after the book came out, a number of folks sort of wrote me about, oh, GameStop, and, you know, just kind of the parallels that they see in other parts of it. And I think, that's absolutely the case. It's, you know, it's a Chinese story, but it's of course, it's something I think that is really relatable, this feeling of, winning and thinking, being so certain that you're winning and seeing the potential to really change your life. Even when in the case of Zhufeng, you know, he's just staring at his tiny little mobile screen and rearranging the pixels on it. And, you know, making bets, outlandish bets on these, you know, on the sort of flimsiest of signs. That whole sort of psyche, I really had fun writing and getting to enter. And of course, there's also that intergenerational piece too, when we see, you know, in some ways his main character really fancying himself just being like so much a man of the moment and so daring. And then of course, learning that some more about his father's past, you know, his father who he scorns as this sort of just a really unimaginative, kind of pathetic creature, really, who has long since kind of surrendered himself to life, and then starting to see the way that actually the story is more complicated than he imagined. That contrast to me, I mean, was really ended up being the heart of the story in some ways, was just the different ways that idealism gets projected over the generations. You know, we see the character like Zhufeng, who's sort of like a post-90s kid who his principal sense of idealism is through wealth, this vision of wealth and success that contrasted against that of his father, who came from a generation where, you know, idealism meant something different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what really impressed me with that story is by the end of the story, you still feel like Zhufeng has that childlike innocence about him, because he really believes. He's still idealistic, basically. He doesn't get disillusioned. He's like, you don't know how the story ends, because like, tomorrow's another day.
Absolutely.
And the government would not do that, kind of.
And I generally don't know how it ended. So he might have been right.
No. What I do know is all of us do resonate with that, like, refresh.
Exactly.
That's global phenomenon. Really powerful story. I wanted to touch on this really interesting scene in the story Hotline Girl, where a character reflects on how good it is to be young, to have a weekend, to be free. And I hope it's not too big a leap here, but I feel like both Ghost Forest and The Land of Big Numbers circle around questions of freedom, but very different questions with very different answers. Could each of you speak on the exploration of the concept of freedom in these projects? And maybe, Bixuan, could you start us off?
Freedom, interesting.
I'm thinking more towards the end of the book. Like, there's a...
Um, I don't know if I was really thinking so much about the theme of freedom when I was writing this book, but if I'm thinking about it now, you know, I guess the scene that comes to my mind near the end is when the father, after the father dies, the narrator remembers the father telling her to stay true to herself and not be so influenced by what society expects of her. And he talks about how he grew up with Confucian values and they were very limiting, and he just focused on working and making a living. And yeah, I mean, I guess one of the biggest questions in my book was really, you know, how to live when someone close to you dies, and like what kind of questions that this brings up about, you know, our priorities and how we want to make use of the time that we have. And so, yeah, I guess that's my more slant way of answering that question.
No, admittedly, it's my slant question too. but yeah, you know, this is an evolution of a character who complains that, oh, this beach would be perfect if the rocks weren't so sharp on our feet, and evolves to, you know, make your own path and kind of lessening that sense of perfection. And, you know, a narrator who's struggling to, you know, against the intergenerational dissonance to kind of a more peaceful place. So yeah, thank you for humoring that question. Tiping, can you speak a bit about freedom, whether for the character, maybe for the characters in Hotline Girl, or just in the narrative in general of Land of Big Numbers?
Yeah, so in the Hotline Girl, I mean, so, you know, we're following the story of a young woman who moves to big city, and she moves to be a singer. She has this idea of wanting to chart out her own path in that way, and she ends up working for working for the government, and in many ways being very much part of the system. But which is something, you know, she works in this government call center, the Satisfaction Center, and of course, as we see over the course of the story, her ex-boyfriend starts calling her and almost stalking her, and we see how that sort of forces her to kind of confront some things about her life. And for me, it was really, yeah, that I thought that tension, which you see so often in contemporary Chinese life, is so fascinating. You know, the different ways that freedom is felt and understood, right? So for someone like Bai Yi in that story, she's so free. She's left behind her family. She's left behind, you know, this ex-boyfriend of hers. She's built this own independent life for herself. And yet we see as a reader just how complicit she is at the same time in a system that makes people very much unfree. And so that's a lot of what that last scene is about, some of that contrast. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we see that elsewhere in the book too, like in the closing story, Gubeko's Spirit, where we see a group of commuters get stuck on a subway platform for months, and the different ways that they end up ultimately frustrated and trying to escape and buck the system. They're trapped for this really bureaucratic government reason, and the ways ultimately that some people end up feeling, even though, of course, they are literally trapped and living underground by sort of diktat by the government, they actually end up in some ways feeling free in that situation, because they feel so, over time, we see how state media makes them out to be these sort of incredible heroes for enduring this situation, for really symbolizing the strength of the nation. And they see themselves as being cared for by the government, which sends in pallets of, you know, food, and people make donations and they're cared for. And that is, to their minds, what makes them free, because it frees them from the cares of having to, you know, traffic in the broader world, where it's, as they see in the nightly bulletins from state media, there's crime, it's dangerous, the economy's bad. And for them, they're so comfortable in the subway tunnel. They've built this cozy society for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, you know, that for them is what outweighs what, you know, we see some other characters in the book thinking about as freedom, and just the different ways that people think about freedom and what it means to be free. You know, it is such a central argument, I think, in Chinese society, and to think about, you know, the choices that we make as a society and to what extent they make us more or less free. And there are so many different ways that people feel, of course, about that across the spectrum in China, obviously between China and the US, and just all those different understandings and pursuits of freedom were something that were absolutely like one of the fundamental sorts of questions I felt that I was engaging with, both as a reporter and also just as someone living in China for so long.
Yeah, and it was incredible to read Gubeko's Spirit, because I know it must have been written before the pandemic, but it really struck a chord for me, this feeling of just, you know, being rallying to the encouragement of the government, living in a certain way. And it was just like, wow, did you feel like your observances and writing had caught up with you?
Yeah, no, that's something that a lot of folk have asked. Is this about the pandemic? I swear it wasn't. I swear it was written before that.
Amazing. One last question towards Bixuan, and then I'll have a question for both of you. Bixuan, ghosts, fortune tellers, the afterlife, the deity Guanyin, they're all references easily as neighbors in Ghost Forest. Can you share some thoughts on the relationship to the supernatural in this community, and how does that reflect on that cultural relationship to reality?
Yeah, and a lot of those references are just written from my own experience in my family and family friends and relatives, hearing people talk about, you know, ghosts and goddesses is such a just big part of growing up, I feel like, in a Chinese family. So I was trying to capture that as a part of the family, as opposed, I wasn't thinking about it as writing, you know, magical realism, or, you know, thinking about it as like a fantastical part. I was just thinking about it as a very core part of this family's experience.
Mm-hmm. No, and that definitely resonates with me. It's always so exciting to see it on the page, because it's true. Your ancestors are walking around and you check in with them once a year, kind of. And that is very much part of the stories that are shared to us in Chinese culture. So it was really very nice to see it on the page as well. I wanted to wrap kind of like in a forecast space. We're in a fairly dynamic and complex time in history, but also in publishing and media appetite. And I think 10 years ago, I would have been amazed to find books that take on Chinese identity with the specificity of each of your projects. But today, it feels like these narratives are part of an increasingly rich tapestry, and that includes music and film and art. What is it like to be an Asian American or Asian Canadian writer today? Do you feel hopeful or apprehensive, or a mixture of these feelings?
I think I can answer. I think I feel hopeful. I don't know much about the publishing industry. My experience of it is pretty limited, but you know, I will say, like, I think, yeah, to be able to share a virtual stage with writers like you both is wonderful, and to hear the feedback from readers, I think, is really exciting. And yeah, I mean, I think we see over and over again that the world needs more stories and different kinds of stories. And I think, and we've seen, I think both of us can probably reflect on just, you know, hearing the kind of feedback from readers that just makes you really excited. Because you know that there's so many more stories that could be told, right? And I think we see the appetite and the enthusiasm, and yeah, it makes me absolutely incredibly excited for what's ahead.
Thank you. Picture in.
Yeah, I think I'm on the same page in that I just feel excited and hopeful, and it's great to see all the books that are coming out from writers of color and marginalized writers. And I hope that just keeps, you know, keeps happening, and that we get to see more and more of these writers supported and published. Mm-hmm.
And along those lines, can you share what writers or artists are exciting to you lately? Just kind of spread it forward. Sophie, anyone you're enjoying reading lately?
Yeah, let's see. So I just finished Peach Blossom Spring, which I loved. It's a fantastic book that is coming out next year. I'm really excited about, there's a collection that I think just came out this month, by Ye Chun called Howl, which I also thought was wonderful. I loved another short story collection, since those are close to my heart, one that came out this year by Brenda Peinado, which is fantastic. I could go on and on.
Thank you. And fiction, what are you enjoying lately?
I'm actually reading my friend Kalu Shavu's novel, Lend Me Something Now, which is coming out in November. Mm-hmm. And I'm also reading a poetry collection by a Hong Kong British poet, Mary Jean Chan, Flesh. Which is so beautiful. And I'm super excited about, I loved Kimi Chang's Bestiary, and she's coming out with a short story collection next summer called Gods of Want. So I'm super excited about that.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Deping. Thank you, Pixuan, for joining us. And thanks to all of you out there for joining in on this fun discussion. These books are so beautiful and so full of truths and insight. So please get as many copies as you can. Ghost Forest and The Land of Big Numbers. I can't recommend these titles highly enough. Thank you so much. And Leslie, over to you.
Thank you, Anna, and thank you to Ping and Peek Xuan. That was a wonderful conversation, and I wish that it could go on longer. And I also, again, want to extend an invitation to both of you to come visit us in person sometime here on Granville Island in Vancouver. We'd love to host you once the world is wide open again. So join us. And in the meantime, thank you for your beautiful books. Thank you to our viewers for tuning in today. There are lots more events at the festival this week, so check our website for updates on what's happening. And goodbye for now.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks so much for having
us. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers Fest. To hear more events like this one, please visit our website at writersfest.bc.ca.